Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues. In this republic of inequality, we are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Niamh O'Rourke, who's a senior social worker in Inclusion Health in St. James's Hospital in Dublin. Niamh, thanks a million for joining me on Reboot Republic.
Thanks, Rory.
And I'm going to add your other title, which is the first acute medicine inclusion health social worker in the world.
Yeah, allegedly.
Great.
I'm the first one in post.
I'm really looking forward to hearing what that is. And in terms of the, just as a reminder to our listeners that we are an independent media, we are a podcast that relies on you as listeners to fund our putting out of these podcasts or producing them. There's a huge amount of them going out. If you can support us, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and become a patron. So Niamh, maybe you could outline the impacts of COVID and inequalities and how they're interacting, and you know, how COVID is worsening inequalities and how people who are in vulnerable groups and are getting through, or how it's impacting on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose the sense I get, since I've become a social worker, and I've been a social worker from around 10 years or so,
it's
been that everything that is brought in front of the government is dealt with in an emergency response situation. So they're reacting. There's no proactiveness. There's no long-term thinking in anything that has been put in front of them. So say, for example, I'm on the inclusion health team in St. James's Hospital. We are a team that's been funded because we have shown we can save the hospital system a large amount of money working with people who are experiencing homelessness and have a lot of health issues. So there's been money bookended at that end of the system. Unfortunately, when people that are experiencing homelessness come to our attention, they're often really, really unwell, in really, really dire health need, and really, really dire housing and accommodation situations. But there's money being put into that system, which is great for those people. But if we had a universal system of looking after people from a very early age, we would need to be fighting to save the life of a 30-year-old who's in homelessness and rough sleep and has chronic addictions. If we were to put in place systems that could look at early education, that, like, there's an early education system called the Perry Preschool Project, which is a longitudinal study for over 40 years that has shown if you put money into early education for people that are in disadvantaged communities, there will be less of those people that will have, they will have less poor outcomes in terms of health, in terms of criminality, in terms of education standards will be higher. So I think sometimes that what we do is we put a band-aid on things. So our team is great. We work really well together. There is an absolute need for our team right now, but it's really a band-aid on people that have been dumped into a system that has failed them all throughout their lives.
And you were saying in terms of COVID that COVID is sort of amplifying those inequalities.
Yeah, I suppose. So when you work in a hospital system, and when you're the social worker on a medical team, you're often the one that is, when they don't know how to fix the things with medicine, if there's not a treatment option, everyone looks at the social worker and says, what are we going to do here? How are we going to fix this? So in terms of social work generally in the hospital, what we always see is people who, where health needs impact on them a bit more than others. So for example, you might see, we would see people who are, say, undocumented in this country. And if you're undocumented and you have, say, a cancer, you need a social worker to fight your corner to get anything you need, because you don't have a medical card, you don't have a PPS number. So what we're seeing with COVID is we're seeing that there, all those inequalities that happen with, in terms of health, are just amplified. It's impacting across the board, but it's impacting on the most vulnerable populations more. Now, we're lucky in terms of the homeless response. There's been a huge response within homeless services to kind of keep people safe and keep them away from the impacts of of COVID as much. So there's lots of like, there's been isolation facilities put in place, cocooning facilities put in place, but there's still a large proportion of people that are don't have that. So for example, you might have someone who is in direct provision. If they are experiencing COVID symptoms, there's been instances of people not being allowed out of the direct provision service. Also, you might have, say, a single parent who comes in with COVID symptoms. How are they meant to self-isolate away from their 2, 3, or 4 children when those children might be very young and they have no social supports outside of that? So what we're seeing in the hospital system is we're seeing that people are really struggling to adhere to public health guidance, and not for not wanting to, but because of other factors in their lives that are not enabling them to do so. So they don't have a social network of support to enable them to actually go home if they have COVID out of the hospital and isolate for a few days, or even actually present with symptoms if they need support, if they need health support. So it's really just, I suppose it just amplifies things for people because the services that might have been there in the first place. So you might have had the mother who had 2 young children, and she might have had a preschool for one and after school for the other. Those services are very limited at the moment. They're not really there. So if that mother needs any support, she doesn't have anybody. Like there's been people that I've worked with in over the years that they literally have only services supporting them because of different things that have happened in their lifestyle. So it might be that they've aged out of TUSLA care in their lifetime and don't have a support network of family. So yeah. if they then go on and have children, they don't have the support. Like I rely on my mother and father hugely for support with my children. But if I don't have that social network of support built up throughout my childhood or it's been broken over the years, it's very difficult for someone to avail of those kind of informal supports that the Irish state expects you to have. So the Irish state expects you to have a fallback of family. It expects you to have the means to be able to look after yourself. So I suppose the net to catch people is very much financial based in Ireland, and it's barely, the financial base barely gets people over the poverty line. So if, for example, say, I suppose in my experience, it seems that what the Irish state tries to do is it tries to ensure that there is a net at the end to make sure people don't go into absolute poverty, but it just holds them in relative poverty for quite a long time. So if you're trying to function as on a very low payment, it's very hard for you to do anything. So you can't buy a big weekly shop. You maybe have to go to the shop around the corner, because if you're going to the shop around the corner, you're not paying the €2, €3 on the bus to go to the bigger shop, but you're spending more money in it in the long run. So I suppose all those kind of inequalities generally impact on people's stress levels, and stress is a huge factor of impacting on people's health generally. And what we see in social work is we see that those kind of impact factors compound over years and generations. And it's the same kind of, people have to end up with the same kind of health outcomes, poor health outcomes as a result.
And of course, that directly links into COVID and the implications for COVID. And we had your colleague, you know, Professor Cleanan Callig on this podcast talking about, you know, how poorer people were sicker with COVID. Yes. And you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, the implications, you know, and how people are presenting or finding it, you know, even more difficult.
Yeah, I suppose from what Kalina and others have seen in the hospital is that poor people generally end up sicker in the hospital and end up with more health issues. And that's been amplified certainly with COVID. It's really just shines a light on people's health needs.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, what you've outlined there around, you know, the situation that people face, you know, be that lone parents, you know, the lack of support networks they have, mm-hmm. people just don't have those, be they, you know, as you said, having a history of being in care, not having networks, you know, those just with not the resources to them, for example, to order online in that sense of scale of shopping. But mm-hmm. it's a gap in our public health strategy around COVID, isn't yeah. it? That we have this thing of self-isolate, but people don't have the capacity or supports, that we provide no supports around that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, like, I when you say things like that, I'm thinking of 4 and 5 different people that I know that are in difficult situations as a result. So, like, I've worked with people who have really poor, say, lung function. So that means that they can't walk very far to the shop. So they'd be reliant on services to help them get their shopping once a week. So they'd be relying on, say, the local family resource centre to go and drop them some shopping. With COVID, they've been told in level 5 that they shouldn't be doing those things. So as a result, there's people that I know of who are absolutely housebound because they can't walk to get their own shopping. They have no one to bring the shopping to them because they have a very limited social network. They rely on a service that was told that they can't do that for them. Mm. So essentially, you've got people locked in their homes, which who could be possibly starving if that were to go on for any length of time. So there's been phone calls to me recently of people in that situation saying, how am I going to get my shopping? And I have worked with people to try and get them. I've set people up with a online shopping account, set it up for them, gone through their shopping list to ask them what they were going to put on it to make sure that they were able to do that. If they didn't have a contact with someone like me, how are they going to do that? There's people mm-hmm. that are really, really isolated. And it would ordinarily be local community groups that would know of people in different circumstances like that might drop in. But if they don't know about that person, that that person has been isolated over years and often generations, they're completely on their own. And I suppose there's in terms of like a public health strategy, the public health strategy for me, it just seems like it's this is what you should be able to do. And yes, if you have a warm home with enough money to heat it, enough money to be able to go out and do your shopping yourself, all that could be fine. But if you don't have a few of those resources, it makes you so much more isolated. It would diminish your mental health so much more quickly. And as a result, it would result if you, so for example, if a person is not able to go get their medications, if they don't have anyone to assist them to get their medications, they will end up in a worse health situation, possibly end up in an ambulance going into a hospital in the middle of COVID. Whereas actually, if we were able to keep someone at home and keep them safe and well at home with the assistance of getting their medications, they would not need to end up in a hospital or with a worse health outcome in the long term. And I suppose what it seems in terms of, I know at the start, we were kind of talking about the short-termism of things.
Mm.
So I suppose for me, it's always a case of what kind of state do we want? What kind of system do we want to, what do we want to value as a state and as citizens of the state? And for me, what I want to value is I want to value everyone's human rights as equal. So everyone has a right to certain standards of housing, healthcare and otherwise. But what it seems that we're valuing is we're valuing that in face only, and we're not backing it up. So for example, in terms of policies, we're saying that you'll hear ministers saying that we want to ensure that all vulnerable people are protected and all of this, but then they're saying in, for example, say if I think of, because I work with homeless people experiencing homelessness primarily, you hear, say, the minister saying there is no issue with people from outside of Dublin receiving accommodation. Yeah, I know that's not the case. Every day, myself and other people in services know that that's not the case, because we know that if we look for accommodation for someone, sorry, they've no local connection, they can. They're not going to avail of any accommodations. When they talk about saying there's enough beds in, say, the homeless system, some of them are mats on floors in services. That's not a bed. A lot of what's provided in homeless service at the moment are provided by private emergency accommodations who are for profit making. In those private emergency accommodations, there is limited social and health supports. So, for example, me as the social worker in inclusion health, it's very difficult sometimes to even get a phone number of a support worker in a private emergency accommodation to ensure that the person I'm discharging, helping discharge today from the hospital, gets what they need the next day. So the system is so if you're in the private end of the homeless accommodation system, you get less support and less support than it would be if someone was in a voluntary organization run accommodation. Mm-hmm. But to get into this voluntary accommodation run service, you nearly have to prove yourself by going through the private system, because the private system is what's given to everyone that comes in. You then nearly have to fight to get into a voluntary service to get an STA or an LTA bed. And to get that, there's a lot of hoops to jump through. There's a lot of paperwork to do. And it's really difficult for people to actually get their needs met. So, for example, I have someone that I've worked with recently that it was very clear this person would need support to make sure they took their medications, would find it very difficult to manage their medications, had a medication that needed to be stored in a fridge. But they were provided with an accommodation that was a shared room with six others with no fridge facilities in the room for their medications. The medications were going to be held by a security member on site. That security member would have to give access to the fridge to get the medications out. This person needed to take medications throughout the day and through the night. If without that security staff member allowing them access to their medications, they weren't complying with their medications. And that person ended up back in hospital because that didn't work for them. Whereas you have other people that might get a much better wraparound service support. But I suppose the system at the moment is so much focused on just getting people into beds and off the streets that they're not thinking long term. So the money has been provided to private accommodations providers who are making a lot of profit off the system, instead of thinking, okay, what if we look at actually providing a functioning, well-resourced housing first system? If a functioning, well-resourced housing first system was provided, it would get people into housing with a wraparound support of looking at their health and social care needs quicker, which would result in them having more dignity in their lives, having what they need closer to them, but also taking into account them possibly having experienced trauma in their past. So for people that in homeless services, a lot of them, like people like Shamrock or Aaron Lambert, will talk about a lot of them have experienced a huge amount of trauma. It's really very difficult for people who've experienced that to be in a shared accommodation with two, three, four others that they don't know who they are. Whereas if we were able to actually fully resource a housing first model, which is shown to be worked internationally, that would be it would save the system money financially in the long term. But again, we look at the short term, get people into a bed and off the streets.
I think what you've set out there is a very stark exposure of, you know, the reality of the absence of Housing First, because we mm-hmm. have a Housing First strategy now in place.
We do.
And a Housing First policy.
We do. Mm.
But what you're saying is it doesn't exist in reality, or is not being resourced enough.
It does exist in reality, but it's not being resourced enough. So it, like, there are people in Housing First properties across the city and across the nation, and they're being really well supported by Housing First workers. But if I looked at my list on Monday when I return back to work, I could give them another 10, 15 people, just of people I think about alone could work well in a Housing First model. But there's no resort, there's no units there. There's a wait time, quite a large wait time at times for people to get into that situation. And that doesn't mean that people aren't trying to get them into Housing First. There's a huge amount of workers in, say, that I work with every day that are really trying to get people into housing units and are trying to amplify their case when it's coming to the Housing First decision panel and all of that kind of stuff. But there's not enough housing units there to provide for that. And the housing units that are provided then are often done through a rental model. So it's short term as well, in that if the state were to provide large scale development of large scale housing to ensure that people that were on the list for 10 years or more all got housed in a quicker amount of time, it would be a cost outlay now, a large cost outlay now, but it would save money in the long term, because you wouldn't be paying private providers who are at the moment. The private, just in terms of homeless services, the private accommodation providers right now are making huge profits, and it's making an industry out of people's vulnerability. You're making an industry out of people experiencing the worst thing that you can experience at times, homelessness, because it's not just about not having a roof over your head. If you can imagine on a day like today, I'm looking out the window, it's been dreary all day. If you don't feel comfortable in your accommodation, whether that be an emergency shelter or whatever it might be, it's very hard to walk the streets all day. It's very hard to be out in the cold. It impacts on your health, your mental health, your ability to think of yourself as worthy. Whereas if we actually said, okay, you're in this situation, you've got to a point where you have no home, you're currently experiencing homelessness, let's wrap you up in cotton wool a little bit. Here is a housing unit. Here is a support worker. Here's someone this is the service going to help you with your health needs. Let's get you into somewhere and then deal with all the causal factors which might have brought you into homelessness. Whereas what we're doing is we're saying, you need to wait over there in that service until something else comes up that's a bit better. And a bit better might still be really bad for that person. Mm. So,
and you know, I think it's really just to draw out another part of that, because you're obviously seeing it.
Yeah.
Like the impact of the homelessness experience, that what we're doing by not providing that housing first,
yes,
immediately.
Yes.
Be that, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, like that damaging impact. And you're talking about it there in terms of, you know, wandering, or not wandering, but like walking the streets, not being able to do that, you know, the actual health, the physical, mental health, you know, of sharing beds. And also, of course, we're seeing, you know, a huge, an increase in the deaths of homeless people as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, maybe you could describe a bit about that in terms of that impact that, of that, mm-hmm, those experiences of emergency accommodation on the streets, what impact it's having in health wise.
So I suppose if you come to the attention, if the inclusion health teams in our city hospitals are worried about a homeless person, a person who's experiencing homelessness, if we're worried about their health, the likelihood of them being close to death is very high. So if we're recently, myself and Kleena and the others on the team were discussing people that we had been worried about for the last year and a half or so. Of the six people we were discussing, there was one person that was still alive. So what we experience for people that are working with people experiencing homelessness, whether it be accommodation providers, health providers, acute health providers, social care workers, what we experience is that there's a huge amount of early preventable deaths. So for example, I'm in my middle 30s. There's been too many people that I know that are younger than me that have died since I became an inclusion health social worker. It's often easier in the city to get accommodation if you're over 55, because we have the small units, the single units that are available through the city councils. Homeless people people that have experienced homelessness over a long term and have experienced periods of rough sleeping don't generally age to 55. They generally have passed away often long before that age. So in terms of the early preventable deaths, what we see is that people have multiple health issues that are treatable. So they might have infectious diseases or infections as a result of drug using, if they were provided with an accommodation that would allow them feel safe enough to engage in their healthcare needs, would be completely treatable. But what we're seeing is that the accommodation can be quite changeable for people. So even if you're in the system, you might be moved beds quickly, and especially with COVID at the moment. So if you become a close contact of somebody, you're moved out of you might have accommodation that you really like and you want to remain there, but you might be moved out of that accommodation because you need to be isolated somewhere else. And that might be good for some people, it might be good for others. But I suppose the accommodation being very changeable, alongside people that have experienced trauma, probably through adverse childhood experiences, trauma since they've become homeless, whether that be through domestic abuse relationships or coercive control, or just being very vulnerable. Like, there's a large population of people that have experienced homelessness who have cognitive impairments, whether they're from childhood or from head injuries and things that they've experienced over their lives. So if you take the changeable accommodation, the history of trauma, and then we're not giving anyone, then the system is saying you need to wait. It's a really impossible situation for people. So you're asking people who have experience of waiting being a scary situation for most people. So, but also you're asking people to wait and be patient when they're saying, if I don't get this, I don't know what's going to happen to me. If I don't get this soon, I don't know whether I can keep on going. If I don't get this soon, I don't know whether I'm going to be alive long enough for me to get my accommodation. So you're dealing with that while also on our team, we're trying to give people hope. So we're always trying to ensure that what we're doing is being realistic, but also saying to people that if you allow us advocate for this accommodation, if you allow us to make sure you have your health needs met, we will keep on fighting on your behalf if you let us, to get you to a situation of being accommodated well. But we're saying that while knowing that that could take a long while. And then we're seeing this person coming into the hospital often over and over again because they have lots and lots of health needs. If I had some of the health needs that the people I see, I would be in the hospital all the time. Whether you're housed or not, if with these health needs, you would be presenting a lot. So we're asking them to wait, but we'll see them again. And then we're still asking them to wait because it's not the council hasn't provided what they require. And often it can be disheartening as a worker to see, you can see the need, you see the stress, you see the pain, you see the trauma. It can be really difficult to see that and say, I'm working on it, while knowing that you're working on it might take 6 months, a year. And sometimes in the back of your head, you're thinking, do they have 6 months, a year to wait?
Yeah.
and you're saying that very strongly. But when it works, when like there's been people that we've worked with, and that we've worked with collaboratively across different voluntary organisations and statutory organisations, and when people get into accommodation, it's fantastic. When they get what they need, it's brilliant. So I have a gentleman that I've been working with for a good while, and he got into accommodation, and he was like, "I'm home. I'm finally able to relax." He said, "I feel like I can leave my front door open here and no one's going to attack me. No one's going to take my things." Because it's a very real experience in homeless services at times, particularly in the kind of the more privately run ones that mightn't have a support structure in place in there. But then it's a case of you see someone getting into accommodation, but you know this, if this had happened 10, 15 years ago, their outcomes in life would have been way better.
Mm, yeah.
So it's a really difficult one to watch.
And I'm really struck by what you said there, that there's a huge amount of preventable early deaths.
Yes.
Like that. So what we're actually saying is these deaths are preventable of yes. people who are experiencing homelessness, but we're not doing it.
Yes. So, yes, there's a huge amount of preventable early deaths. So a lot of people that experience homelessness, they have really complicated health at times. So because you're thrown into the mix, adverse childhood experiences, which can cause impacts on the person. You're thrown into the mix, the coping with the trauma from those adverse childhood experiences by maybe means of addiction, and sometimes really heavy and what people might say as chaotic addictions. So those addictions then have more impacts on the person. Then you have the poor accommodation to no accommodation that impacts on the person's health and their body as well. So I'm always struck by how old some people look when they come in the hospital, but how young they are on paper.
Yeah.
So you look at their date of birth and you look at the person in front of you, and you're looking at the person in front of you who is really frail, who might be walking on a Zimmer frame, who looks possibly 70, and you look at the paper and go, he's 44. So you're actually seeing, at times you're seeing geriatric care needs at a much younger age. So Clean and Ikealig and our clinical nurse specialist, Jess Sears, would have done some reports through DePaul on early aging in the homeless population. So that early aging is stark at times. So for example, to bring a little bit of hope into it, because I'm finding my heart weighing at the moment, to bring a little bit of hope into it, when you see someone being accommodated and having the wraparound supports, their health outcomes, you can nearly see how well they look in comparison. So for example, that gentleman I was thinking of earlier, when he went into his accommodations and I had some belongings belong to him, so I dropped him to his place, he looked lightened. He looked younger, which to me, because I am not the health professional, that I'm the social workers, so I'm looking at him thinking, he looks better. If he looks better, he must feel better. If he feels better, his health must be better.
Yeah.
So that alone, providing someone with stability, like I always think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we're not providing people with the baseline stability. Without a baseline stability, people can't achieve. So you're asking them to try and achieve all these things, and so you're expecting them to be able to hold down a job, but you're not providing people with the baseline stability. So in our team, we talk about psychological safety a lot. And what we say is that our team provide each other psychological safety within our team to say what needs to be said to each other, to do what we need to do. We find if we don't have that connection with each other, we can't do the work we do. So if then we're thinking about in the hospital, we call them patients, our clients, our service users, if we haven't provided with them with the psychological safety and feeling safe, they cannot achieve, because no human being can.
It is you know, that base that you say and Maslow's hierarchy of needs is so important, because fundamentally it is shelter. You know, shelter is one of those basic needs. And of
Absolutely.
Course, it's not shelter as in a hostel, but no. shelter as in a home. And, you know, what you're saying very clearly is that, yes, Housing First is there. It's providing some supports, but it's nowhere near resourced enough. And that the solutions are there, which Absolutely. Is within Housing First, but it needs to be really resourced properly.
Absolutely. And like when people go into Housing First that we know, say in our team alone, when they go into Housing First, we see them less often in the hospital. So we might have seen, say a person 15, 20 times last year, and they're maybe housed now within a Housing First model. We'll still see them because they'll have longer on care needs. But instead of the 15, 20 times, you might see them the 3-4 times that they're due to come in to see their consultant, which means that their health is better. It means it's also costing the health service less. So for every person that presents to the emergency department or every person that doesn't come to their outpatient appointment, it costs the hospital system money. But if we were providing people with a, like just within, say, within the homeless sector, if we were providing people with Housing First with a key worker that's dropping in 2-3 times a week, depending on the needs, and a health service that they know that they can trust, whether that be Safety Net, because people really trust Safety Net, GMQ, different services like that, they wouldn't need to come for unscheduled care in an acute hospital. They wouldn't need to then they would then be able to feel safe at home, supported, and actually live the lives that they want to live. And that life might be sitting down with the TV on, their own kettle, their own belongings around them, and just reading the paper. It might be as simple as that. So, for example, the reason that I always wanted to work with homeless persons is because my uncle was homeless. So he died just last year and died too early. But when he was housed, so he was supported by DePaul to be housed. When he was housed, his life changed. He was able to have, we bought him a TV in our family. We bought him a kettle. He had his own toaster. He started to buy me and my children presents.
Yeah.
Because he was safe to do that. And it's lovely seeing people get to that situation. But it's too late. It shouldn't be at their last 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years. It should be when they're actually able to have a long, fulfilling life. And long, fulfilling lives mean different things to different people. But people need to be able to choose what their long, fulfilling life is. They don't need that choice being taken away from them.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry to hear that about your uncle. And it's,
oh yeah, he was deadly though. He's brilliant.
He sounds it. He absolutely sounds it. And it's incredible how the different things that motivate us to do what we do. And I suppose in terms of just, you know, finishing up, I think, you know, you've really spoken incredibly about, you know, those kind of inequalities and, you know, the damage that we do as a society to people. And, you know, just maybe in terms of where do you see, you know, what's your vision for what Ireland should be doing?
What's my devs, Aisling? I suppose for me, as what I want for what I think Ireland should be is what we sell Ireland as. So we sell Ireland as this place where we are a community-based country that everybody knows everybody, but everybody supports everybody. That's what we sell on our Fall to Ireland as. I would like that to be our Ireland. I would like it to be a situation where we ensure that everyone has a right to a home, because I think it needs to be a constitutional right at this point. Because until it is, I don't think there's going to be political will or political action to ensure that happens. So everyone should have a right to a home. I think we need to have a situation where we have some sort of universal healthcare system as well, because if we have those two things, yes, they will cost a lot of money to put them in place, they will save a lot of money in the long term. But what I care about is that people will be able to engage in long, fulfilling lives of their own choosing if they have those basic needs met. Because what we're doing is we're essentially asking people to achieve going to college, to get a good, decent job, but we're not meeting their basic needs. If I wasn't to meet my children's basic needs, I would have a member of my profession coming to ask me why I wasn't providing those basic needs for my children. But as a state, we're not providing those basic needs for our citizens. And yes, it would cost more money in taxes, but we would then all be able to, if we look at what the most vulnerable populations in our country need, it would benefit our whole country and our whole citizenship. Because if we provide things at a universal level, taking into account what the most vulnerable people need, it would benefit us all. Because if we have a universal healthcare system, that's grand. I can stop paying the health insurance. I'll have more. I'll be able to engage in that healthcare. I'll be able to go to the hospital and know that I don't need to worry about getting the bill.
Mm.
I'll be able to make, if everyone has accommodation, if everyone's provided with accommodation, I won't need to worry about the person I see begging around the corner and the shop around the corner for me, because I'll know that he hopefully has his own place. You'll see less of those kind of very in your face experiences of the poverty around.
Yeah. Niamh, I think that's a really, you know, incredible vision that we all share, you know, and that I know listeners to this podcast absolutely share and believe in, and all of us are committed to try and bring it about. And I think, you know, for too long, people in this country have been failed and abused by the state and by its institutions and policies. And it is absolutely two basic rights, the right to housing, the right to health, that people should have. And we as a society should ensure that everybody has. And of course, you know, a person we quote a lot on this podcast is Richard Wilkinson, the author of The Spirit Level, and how, you know, more unequal societies, everybody does worse.
Absolutely.
And this idea that, you know, it would cost a huge amount of money is absolutely right. But of course, it would save a massive amount, as you have outlined, in terms of healthcare costs, but also as a society, like how well we would all be if everyone was housed and everyone has access to health. So I think that's a fantastic vision, and I believe we will get there.
Well, we'll give it a go anyway.
We sure will. Niamh O'Rourke, thanks so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic, and we'll have you back if you'll come.
Okay, thanks, Rory.
Thank you. And reminder, as always, to our listeners, that you can support us. We're an independent media, cost to put out these podcasts. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a patron, whatever you can each month. And as well, we love to hear your views and comments and feedback. You can, on Patreon, you can send us comments, or you can go over to Twitter. We're at Reboot Republic or at Rory Hearn. You can send us on comments or issues you'd like to cover. And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you very much.